Last Sunday morning, I started retelling the life of Jesus, some of the simple incidents that make up what we identify with in his life and find a great deal of strength in for our own lives. We started with his birth, proceeded through his young manhood when he worked in the carpenter shop in Nazareth, and closed with his baptism at the hands of John the Immerser in the Jordan River. No sooner had Jesus emerged from private life into the public to be baptized, evidently at the close of one of John's days of baptizing large masses of people. The text says when all the people had been baptized, Jesus was baptized. Then he went immediately into the wilderness, withdrawing from public life and going back into private life for a 40-day struggle with Satan himself. The first thing that sort of amazes me about the story of the temptation that was read to you this morning is its source. Nobody was there except Jesus and Satan. Well, the angels of God are said to have ministered to him. The wild beasts were there with him. But there was nobody else to bring the story back. Jesus had to be the source of this account of the temptation. Why did he tell it? It certainly wasn't to satisfy some curiosity of ours about what went on immediately after his baptism or whether he ever suffered exactly as we had suffered. It wasn't just to add more material to the Gospels. There's plenty of material there. It had to be a highly selective process to narrow down the materials to what we actually have. The reason for his telling the story of the temptation must be something different from either of these. I think it lies in the fact that when you and I suffer, we need to know that he has suffered, that he has gone through something of what we go through. My temptation may not be exactly the same as his, but he certainly went through temptation. And I think it also indicates the fact that Jesus' temptation left something permanent on his soul. You imagine sleeping in that wilderness for 40 days and nights and hearing that desert wind howl and seeing those wild beasts around you and having the personal encounter with Satan himself. It would have left an indelible impression. And imparting that to his disciples would have given them strength for the kinds of temptations they had to go through on a daily basis. Our adoration of Jesus is such that we almost keep him from being real. We're so sure that he never could have done wrong that we don't really take seriously his temptations to do wrong. I think our adoration would be even better if we could take into consideration statements of Scripture about his temptation. Second chapter of Hebrews, for example, closes by saying that he was tempted so that he might succor those who are tempted. The fourth chapter ends by saying we do not have a high priest who cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities or who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, the more recent versions say, but one who was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Now, I don't think that means that Jesus underwent every specific temptation that every specific human being will ever undergo. That would be an awful lot of individual temptations. I've never been tempted in some ways that other people have been tempted. I've never once been tempted to get drunk or to take any kind of drug or to steal money from somebody else who had what I would like to have. But on the other hand, the things I have been tempted to may be things that don't bother the person at all who succumbed to one of those. Each of us is quite different. And what the text does affirm is that Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are, that he underwent every different kind of temptation, not that he underwent every specific temptation that can be laid upon any one of us. And really, he had no advantage over ourselves in that he was a man, the temptations were real, except the advantage that when temptation came to him, he didn't have a memory of having failed once before. Seems to me that what causes me to fall most is that when the temptation occurs, I remember that I gave into this once before and I overcame it. Wouldn't be too bad to give in again, and hopefully there'd be another recovery. Jesus was not weakened by that past experience of failure, but his temptations were real. That's part of what the text is saying to us. And then for centuries, people have been amazed at the timing of his temptation. Lots of lessons have been taught around that. Jesus came up from being baptized, and immediately the Spirit drove him into the wilderness, the text says. And so often, we've noted that just when people are experiencing the exhilaration of having obeyed the gospel, there's never a time when your motivation is clearer, when you're more sure that you'll continue to the very end doing just what you ought to do, than when you come out of the water of baptism. And it was that moment when Satan came to tempt him. so that we're reminded there's never a time when we're really safe. Now, the point of his temptations, although there are three of them, seems to me to be singular, just one point. And that is, the devil is offering another way to become the Messiah. How shall Jesus go about it? He knows what he's supposed to do. God has sent him into the world to save fallen men. He's going to be the Messiah, but how shall he proceed? How shall he use the power that he has from the Father? Shall he work miracles and dazzle people? Shall he feed everybody who is hungry? Shall he just fall down before Satan and then rule the world immediately? Or how exactly should he go about it? So Satan tempted him, but the Spirit drove him into the wilderness. Who caused this temptation, God or the devil? We often ask that when temptation comes. Who caused Job's? Well, the devil brought the temptation, yet God allowed the temptation. Who caused Abraham's? God saw Genesis 22:1, Abraham, and he said he would test him. He would prove him to see if Abraham was really his disciple. God brought the proving, the testing. It seems to me that one temptation from the devil's viewpoint is to seduce, but the same temptation from God's standpoint is to test, to prove. God doesn't want us to fall. He didn't want Abraham or Job to fall. But neither does he want us to be pampered. He wants us to be real persons, to undergo the freedom of choice. And that's exactly what happened to Jesus in the wilderness. He was led there so he could be tested. Satan meant it for evil. The Father meant it for good. Now, the background of the temptations we're familiar with. They went on for a 40-day period. At least that period of fasting in the wilderness went on for that long. You remember how many days it rained when the floodwaters were coming? 40 days. Or do you remember how long Moses was gone into the mountain when he came back with the tables of stone with the Ten Commandments on them? 40 days. Or how long it was from the juniper bush, the broom tree, where Elijah laid down and begged God to kill him, till he got over the cave at Mount Sinai where God recommissioned him and told him to go back where Jezebel and the Baal worshippers were and do his work? 40 days. Or how long it was that the Israelites were in the wilderness? 40 years. Or how long Saul, David, Solomon reigned? 40 years. The 40 itself is probably symbolical. Here is a complete period of time, a sustained and prolonged period of time under which the testing goes on. And he's 40 days in the wilderness. Now, wilderness to me is a forest, just a woods where there's lots of undergrowth and you can scarcely ply your way through. But I've seen the wilderness of Sinai from the air. And I've gone through a little bit of the wilderness of Judea on the ground, and I know it isn't that way. This wilderness is what we would call wild desert area. Nothing there but rocks, crags, ravines. The people who've traveled it over longer periods of time say that sometimes those rocks get so hot they blaze and glow like furnaces under the heat of the sun. It's in that kind of wilderness that he undergoes the temptation. There was an area which the Old Testament people called Jeshimon, which means the devastation, that lay down south of the city of Jerusalem and extended east to the Dead Sea. It was about 15 miles wide and about 30 miles long. And that's the period known as the wilderness, or the place, the area known as the wilderness. And that's where Jesus was alone with the wild beasts. Have you ever wondered how he slept during that period? No beds out there. That's where Bishop Pike met his death, you may remember. Rambling, wandering around through the wilderness area in the hot sun, lost his way and died from apparently a sunstroke. A man who was known so widely in American press for what he didn't believe. But the wilderness area is a very difficult area for a person to be banished in for this period of time, isolated from everybody else. No food, no people. Can you imagine what it would be like to have those wild animals crawling around during the night while you're trying to get your rest? And then we're told in the text that he fasted for the 40 days and nights. I've never fasted very long at a time, and usually not by choice then, and I suppose that's common experience. But there's something about withdrawing from food that sharpens a person's sensitivities. It makes him more aware of what's really important in life. And after the first meal or two passes, individuals say who've gone through it for long periods of time, you begin to think about more serious things, more important things than just filling the body over and over again. When Handel wrote The Messiah, it said that he went into a room, locked himself shut, stayed 2 weeks, and wrote The Messiah during that 2 weeks. And people would bring food and put it on the outside of the door, and he'd taste it, sample it, but he ate scarcely anything at all during that 2 weeks. His whole heart was centered on that one piece of music, that one story. And much the same thing seems to have happened to Jesus. And yet, out of all the wilderness area and the 40 days and the fasting, the most striking detail of it all to me is to try to figure out how did it really happen. The devil took him up to the pinnacle of the temple. If you'd been standing in the temple court that day, would you have seen Jesus and Satan standing on top of the temple? He took him up into a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, there isn't a mountain that high that we know anything about, and there's certainly not one in Palestine. How are we to understand this? Well, some of the most committed biblical believers have understood it as largely an internal struggle. They've understood it as Jesus showing or being shown by Satan in his mind and out of his thought what it would be like to jump off that temple or to see all those kingdoms from that mountain. It would appear that a little more than that is intended. That there is some high place from which a view is gotten of what will be ruled. And yet, I think we would make a mistake to become overly literal and insist that he had to see every single part of the earth at one glance, unless it's done by spiritual miracle. That's possible, of course. Luke says he saw it in a moment's time. But there's largely an internal struggle here, and not just an external thing. I doubt whether you would have seen anything if you'd been looking up from the temple when that occurred. I would understand it rather as a spiritual event, more than a physical event. But the temptations themselves, what were they? The first temptation was, after he'd been hungry for 40 days and nights, if you're the Son of God, why don't you command that these stones be made into bread? It's said that those little limestone pieces, round, often look like a small loaf of bread. They would remind him. That's certainly a tempting thing after you've had nothing to eat for a long time for someone to say, you've got the power, why don't you use it? It would have tempted Jesus, I think, along several lines. He had to be hungry, and he certainly had the power. Why not use it? He uses it at Cana in Galilee to turn water into wine. What's wrong with turning stones into bread? Later he'll multiply one small boy's lunch into enough loaves and fish to feed a whole multitude of thousands. Why not? I think if we understand Jesus' temptations in terms of the personal self-interest involved in them, we'll miss the point. Rather, it seems to me that the point is, here is a way you could lead everybody in the world. You can not only satisfy your own hunger, use that power. It can serve your purposes. Why go to a cross? Look at all the poverty. There were so many taxes on the Palestinians, a tax for voting, the poll tax, a tax for the roads, a tax for meat, a tax for salt, a tax for the house. Anything the Romans could think of to tax, they taxed. And then the publicans bought the right to collect the taxes and added their own measure on top. And the average person was in a squeeze. And if the political discussions of our time remind us of the needs of the American people, as affluent as we are, you can imagine what an appeal it would have been to say, why don't you just feed everybody? Wouldn't it be terrible to die out here in the wilderness? To starve to death when you could be the Messiah? At least you want to make enough bread for yourself. But if you just do it for everybody else, you'd win everybody overnight. Have you ever thought about how hard it is to pray on an empty stomach? When you're really wanting food, missionaries have gone into other lands, especially after World War II this happened. They tried to preach to people and those people were hungry and they didn't have enough clothes. They didn't have a secure place to rest. And the missionaries seemed to have all those things and more. And they found it impossible to preach to people who were in such needs. And so American relief began to be sent by Christians. It wasn't long until we had another problem. It's true that it's hard for a person to pray when his stomach is hurting. But it's also true that a lot of people have full stomachs and still don't pray. And we created a few rice Christians, as they're called. People who only responded as long as the food was coming. So Jesus' response was to quote Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, where Moses was rehearsing with the younger generation that had grown up in the wilderness how God had taken care of the older generation of that wilderness, how he'd given manna from heaven. And he said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Jesus was not going to buy people's allegiance. He was interested in their having food. His story of the judgment, Matthew 25, 31 through 46, shows that. He pictured people hungry, thirsty, naked, sick, imprisoned, strangers, and he wanted his people to take care of those people. But he wouldn't do this as a means of winning people to himself. You'll have everything you need if you'll just follow me. He never made that sort of appeal. So he turned Satan away. The second approach was, why don't you go up on the pinnacle of the temple and cast yourself off? Dazzle people. Do the spectacular. And they'll all serve you. Why go to a cross? Now, Josephus says that that temple was built on the side of a mountain which supported both Jerusalem and the temple. And that on the south side, the pinnacle went straight down. And the wall of the temple went straight into the side of the wall of the hill. And that if you stood on top of the temple and looked down, you were looking down 450 feet. And Josephus says nobody can look down without becoming dizzy. If you ever looked down a canyon? Ever ridden those mules down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, look over the side 600-800 feet straight down? It does have a little bit of an unsettling effect. And so Satan says, why don't you just cast yourself off? It'll be so striking when the angels of God are charged to lift you up and not let you get hurt. And he quoted to him Psalm 91, verses 11 and 12. He'll give his angels charge concerning you. They'll bear you up lest you dash your foot against a stone. Do it. Dazzle people. They were really looking for the dazzling. Josephus again says that between the years 67 and 37 B.C., no fewer than 100,000 Jews died in abortive rebellions against Rome. Anybody who came along and said, let's go, they were ready to follow. Gamaliel cited some cases of that in Acts 5. In Acts 21, we hear about an Egyptian, and Josephus tells about an Egyptian who told his followers, let's all go out to the Mount of Olives, and once we're there, we'll just say one word, and the whole wall of the city of Jerusalem will fall. Well, people can promise, but then eventually the time comes to deliver, and you've got to have a new Messiah because it doesn't quite work out. But we haven't gotten over all of that. Any guru who hits our country gets a following. Anybody with a dazzling, spectacular new message seems to have lots of people just waiting in the wings. And the old, the commonplace doesn't seem quite that attractive. Why not dazzle people? They'll serve you immediately. Malachi 3 verse 1 says, the Lord, speaking of the Messiah, shall come suddenly to his temple. Can you think of any more sudden way? Then just crawl up to the top and jump. They'll all know you're the Messiah. I think it's necessary to plow through it like that because I never wanted to jump off a temple in my life. And I suspect you didn't. It's not a tempting thing to me. Why should it be such a severe temptation to him? But then I've never looked down the road 3 years and seen a cross in my path either. And if I had a choice between doing something spectacular and really believing God would save me from being hurt, or having to go to a cross where I knew I would be hurt terribly, the choice would become acute. Now, actually, the 91st Psalm is about trust. And if you read it, he talks about God as our shield and buckler and how God will take care of us. And Jesus knew that it isn't trusting God to go out somewhere and test him, jump and see if he'll catch you. Trusting God is not even needing to do the spectacular. You already know he loves you and that he's going to work through you to do his will. And so Jesus a second time turned him down, this time with Deuteronomy 6:16. You shall not test or prove or tempt the Lord your God. It's a quotation again from Moses, where Moses is recalling the waters of Massah, or we usually know them as the waters of Meribah. Massah means to prove, Meribah means contention, and it was that place in the wilderness where the Israelites murmured until water came from a rock so they'd have something to drink. And they proved or tested God when they didn't trust him to provide and kept on murmuring against him. And then Satan came with his third, up into a high mountain. All the kingdoms of the earth, they're yours. You can be the Messiah, just one momentary bowing of the knee in front of me, if you don't mind. Just fall down and worship me for a moment, and then it's all yours. The way of compromise. Jesus had no political power or influence. Here's the perfect way. The whole world is his. Just a moment of bowing. It was a common thing in religion in that day to syncretize everything that came along. Romans didn't mind if somebody brought in Osiris from Egypt or Cybele from somewhere else. What's another god in the pantheon? But Jesus wouldn't have somebody else alongside the Father. A moment of worship to Satan and then the rest of the worship to God would have defeated his whole purpose, and he knew it. It could have been a tempting thing. After all, the Jews have for a century been trying to get rid of Roman domination. Here is a way. You know Jesus would have ruled them better than Rome was ruling them. You know you can ease the burden of those people, and it's yours if you'll just fall down before me. An easier road to the Messiahship again. But again, Jesus quotes Deuteronomy 6, this time verse 13. You shall worship the Lord your God. Him only shall you serve. He knew that all Satan could give was the external kingdoms. He couldn't give that righteousness, joy, and peace in the Holy Spirit, which Paul says the kingdom of God is in Romans 14. And then Satan, or the tempter, went away for a season, Luke says. We get an insight into the temptations of Jesus, and we have to make the bridge somehow to our own. One way of doing that is to realize that just because you're tempted doesn't mean that you've committed sin. We sometimes say, may as well do it as to think it. Don't let yourself be convinced. Even if you sit and daydream about the thing, you know what you're doing. You're weakening your resistance so that when the actual situation occurs, you're swept away by it. But there is still time as long as you have it in a dream and it isn't in reality. The temptation is not sinful. It can be met. And then there's the fact that sometimes we're tempted to do a good thing. It's just not the best thing. There's nothing wrong with turning stones to bread. There isn't anything wrong, so far as I can see, in jumping off a building and allowing God to catch you if that's what he wanted to do. And I suppose there's nothing wrong with ruling all the kingdoms of the earth if one would do it benevolently. There's a backside to those where you have to bow the knee to Satan first, sure. But in some of the instances, at least, the thing Jesus was tempted to do was within itself good. It just wasn't what God wanted. It wasn't the highest good. It required surrender somewhere else before the good was done. We so often face the same situation. Life gets tied up with things that are all right. They're just not the highest good that we could go toward. Then probably the most piercing part of the temptation was when Satan said in 2 out of the 3 times, if thou be the Son of God, do this or that. They were still saying that around the cross in Matthew 27, verse 40. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. Trying to plant some doubt in Jesus' mind. Can't you imagine what it was like for the Son of God himself to grow up in a carpenter's shop, obscurity, poverty, and now to go out and announce his leadership? I don't know in what sense discouragement could have come. But he did grow weary on occasions, and the task must have seemed all but impossible. If you're the Son of God, just planting a little doubt in that hungry heart. I don't know about you, but when I'm tired or hungry, it's not a very good time for decision making. He tries every way he can to lead Jesus in the wrong direction. But the lesson that comes through to us is that there's no temptation which has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will with every temptation make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. It wasn't just a matter of Satan tempting Jesus one time and going away forever. Luke 22, 28, when the Lord's Supper was being instituted, Jesus said, you have been with me through my trials. They weren't with him in the wilderness, but they'd been with him through lots of testing. Satan kept coming and going, trying and trying again. But Jesus' answer, well, his answer in this case, all 3 times, came from Deuteronomy 6 through 8. That was his arsenal of weapons. And the opening verses of Deuteronomy 6 say, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. With that text in his mind, Jesus overcame. It's a sad thing for a person to go all through life really wanting to do the best and always afraid to start. Afraid he just won't be able to overcome the temptations to fall away. It's sad, too, when a person has tried and has failed and can't quite get the courage to start again. The temptations of Jesus are here for this very reason. He was tempted at the very point of his mission, and he overcame. And now he's able to help us overcome when we're tempted at the very point of ours. Do you need to do his will? Would you? While we sing. Are you the
mountain.